Attention listeners, AfterSight's annual hike is coming up on July 27th.
It was a really good experience for me.
Visit aftersight.org/hike and become an audio trekker today.
That hike today gave me so much courage.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Daily Camera and Longmont Times Call, read by Anita Head. This is being recorded on Monday, April 22nd, 2024. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Girls Flag Football Facing Sanction Vote by Kyle Newman. Lafayette Global Tea Tour by Andrea Grajeda. And other miscellaneous articles. CHSAA, Girls Flag Football Facing Sanction Vote by Kyle Newman. After 2 years of explosive growth as a pilot program in Colorado, Girls Flag Football is at a critical juncture. The sport will either become sanctioned at Tuesday's CHSAA Legislative Council meeting, or it will be voted down, in part over concerns about logistical issues involved in getting flag football off the ground. 10 states have sanctioned the sport so far, with Tennessee the latest. Colorado's pilot, which started with 25 teams in 2022, grew to about 1,300 players across 52 schools this past season. The pilot was largely funded and organized by Denver Broncos Charities, while Denver Public Schools, Cherry Creek School District, and Jeffco Public Schools also sponsored it. Going into a couple of years ago, we knew there were some interest, but I didn't realize the level of support and engagement we'd get. The adaptability of the sport to our state and how fast it would take off, said Patrick Simpson, Jeffco's executive director of athletics. In initial conversations, we were talking about 10 to 12 girls per team. But right away from the first tryout, I got a text from the AD at Chatfield that he had 85 plus girls at tryouts. It's been unbelievable the amount of girls interested in playing. Despite the popularity, several groups of schools will vote no on Tuesday on sanctioning, including the Front Range League, the Patriot League, and the Northern Colorado Athletic Conference. One main concern is field availability and scheduling. The 2024 CHSAA rulebook calls for a field that's 40 yards wide and 80 yards long, a change from the 30 by 60 fields that Jamborees, single-day tournaments usually featuring 6 teams and 3 games going on at once, were played on during the pilot. The larger size aligns with what is most common in other states, although CHSAA's proposed rules also say 30 by 60 yard fields may be used for lower level and regular season invitation formats. If the field changes, you can't play a jamboree because you can't play 3 games simultaneously, Kylie Russell, the district athletic director for Adams 12 five-star schools, said on CHSAA Zoom call Thursday. That completely changes the outline of the game and what it looks like with the scheduling. Travis Steiner, the athletic director at Platte Valley, said his Patriot League doesn't know if the logistics are all in place for it to function the way it needs to function. Those logistics include concerns over the availability of officials for a fall season when tackle football is also underway. The Broncos organized and trained officials over the past couple of seasons. The current lack of a flag football committee, which would be immediately formed if Tuesday's vote passes, is also an issue for him. The timeline to flip it from April to August and have all of these pieces in place and make sure our official assigners can handle this is a bit short for us, Steiner said. Getting a little bit more time to get refined would make it a better product for the schools from the get-go. The NFHS is putting together a task force to appoint a rules committee and write a national rule book for the sport. NFHS Executive Director Dr. Carissa Nyhoff said, "There is urgency to streamline the sport because it is growing so fast, and the organization hopes to have the rulebook ready by the 2025-26 school year." According to the latest NFHS participation survey, 20,875 girls played flag football nationwide in 22-23. Most were in Florida, which has sanctioned the sport since 2003. Florida has found success with flag football as a spring sport when it doesn't have to compete with tackle football for officials and field availability. But FHSAA Flag Football Commissioner Jeremy Hernandez acknowledges the wide variety of rules and regulations are becoming a common talking point amid the sport's growth. Arizona is playing on a full 100-yard field and kicks field goals. Some states play on 60-yard fields. Some play on 80-yard fields, Hernandez said. Some are using NFL flag rules. Some are using National Intramural Recreational Sports Association rules. Some are using their own combination. It's kind of a hodgepodge right now, and it's all over when it comes to specific rules, the size of the field, rushing on offense, and the QB, contact, even the type of flags that are being worn. Also complicating the matter locally is the Broncos' uncertain role in the sport going forward. We wouldn't be here without the Broncos, especially this fast, Simpson said, but athletic directors are unsure what role the Broncos will play should the sport become sanctioned. Broncos grant money paid for equipment and coaches' stipends during the pilot program, and the pilot state championships were held at the Pat Bowlen Fieldhouse. Home and away jerseys were provided by Nike using the Broncos connection. The Broncos declined to comment for this story, but Fossil Ridge Athletic Director David Walk said the Broncos Director of Youth and High School Football suggested at a recent meeting the team might still offer some financial help. He said he would do their best to help support it, and one of the questions we did ask in that conversation was, what happens if this proposal doesn't pass? Are the Broncos going to continue to financially support the sport? He couldn't speak to that at the moment. Supporters of sanctioning flag football now say the hurdles shouldn't stop CHSAA. Girls wrestling and unified bowling, when we brought those in, it wasn't like we knew exactly what that picture was going to look like at the end, Lakewood Athletic Director Michael Hughes said on Thursday's CHSAA Zoom call. We took some things on faith and with the mindset of we're going to come up with the best possible situation for our kids in that emerging sport. In addition to the high participation numbers, flag football's relatively low cost is around $10,000 annually per school, a figure that includes travel, coaching stipends, uniforms, and equipment, according to estimates by multiple athletic directors. That would make it one of CHSAA's most affordable sports for schools and for individuals who only need to purchase cleats and a mouth guard. And in fact, that last year's CHSAA participation survey revealed about 52% of players weren't planning on playing a fall sport. And Cherry Creek Director of Athletics Larry Bull argues the sport is connecting with a previously untapped sector of female high school athletes. It's created a sense of pride and community and purpose, and it's a great opportunity for a group of young ladies to be connected to their schools, the majority of whom previously weren't going to be doing anything with their school in that season anyway, Bull said. Women's flag football is also gaining traction at the college level, with a variety of NAIA schools currently offering it and will be debuting it in the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics in a 5-on-5 format. For all those reasons, Arvada West star junior quarterback Taylor Swanson, who led the Wildcats to the championship last fall, says sanctioning the sport would be a step in the right direction to providing opportunities for all the girls who have built this sport in Colorado to have the chance to play in college and possibly for the national team. Ralston Valley's Addison Cadwell and Arvada West's Sarah Walker got invites to try out for the U-20 national team, with Cadwell headed to play at Kansas Wesleyan University. Plus, Mountain Vista's Braylon Looney earned the MVP of the West region at the USA Flag Football Talent ID Camp, with a likely invitation to try out for the U-17 national team on the way. My hope is for a lot more opportunity and for scholarships for girls like that, Arvada West coach Mario Lopez said. I had a lot of young female athletes who were playing multiple sports, but really loved flag and stuck with it in the second year and took it seriously as a sport. It being an official high school sport will benefit those female athletes in Colorado a ton. CHSAA Commissioner Mike Krueger, who can't vote on the matter, described himself as a staunch supporter of the sport's attempt to become sanctioned, but he also painted a picture in which flag football's momentum toward official status could be derailed if the vote fails. If districts want to continue to pilot it, my response would be, to what extent, Krueger said. What are we going to learn in additional 2 years of pilot that we don't already have the data to support? It could just go away if no league or district is willing to pilot it again and just become a club or intramural sport. Simpson, Bull, and Denver Public Schools District Athletic Director Kevin Benji all of whom have been pushing hard for sanctioning, are determined not to let that happen if Tuesday's vote doesn't go their way. It's not a matter of if Flag passes, it's just a matter of when it passes, Simpson said. I would be 100% in support of going through another pilot process and helping answer questions for schools that voted against it. If their concern is that we haven't established proof of concept and we need to extend the pilot, we would keep it going in some capacity. It's just a matter of what we've got to do to take that last step. Lafayette, Global Tea Tour, library event kicks off Week of Cultural Programming by Andrea Grajeda. The Lafayette community took a tour around the world at the International Tea Event Sunday, where community members from different countries shared their unique teas, snacks, and culture. The Lafayette Public Library, 775 West Baseline Road, hosted the International Tea Event, which served as the kickoff to a week of programming inspired by the Dia de los Niños, or Children's Day event called Dia. Sunday's event and the week of programming is a way for the library to promote literacy of every language and culture, organizers said. Boulder County community members Sunday represented Bangladesh, Mexico, Thailand, India, Japan, England, and Argentina. Through the geographical and cultural differences, everyone was united under tea. Betsy Yadden, enrichment librarian, said that through Saturday, the library will host a variety of events for story times where people can share their own cultures. Stanley Hotel, plan to save sail approved by Lucas High, BizWest. Members of the Colorado Economic Development Commission gave their unanimous blessing Thursday to a plan that could allow another state agency to step in and save a previously approved and now amended plan that would see the Stanley Hotel sold and a long-languishing film center at the iconic Estes Park Lodge completed. With the ADC's go-ahead, the Colorado Educational and Cultural Facilities Authority can move forward into the next stages of its plan to buy the 116-year-old, 140-room hotel that inspired Stephen King's The Shining novel from longtime owner Grand Heritage Hotel Group. The sale, according to state officials, would unlock millions of public dollars needed to expand the hotel and build out the Stanley Film Center, which, according to its website, will be the permanent home for film, fun, and the horror genre, and will highlight the key role that Stanley Kubrick's The Shining film adaptation has played in horror history. Arizona-based Community Finance Corp., a nonprofit group that specializes in forming public-private partnerships that provide alternatives to traditional funding schemes governments often use to pay for capital improvements and infrastructure projects, was previously in line to buy the Stanley through a fairly complex financing mechanism from Grand Heritage by way of a $475 million bond issuance from CECFA. Under that deal structure, CFC was set to serve as the temporary custodian of the Stanley Hotel and the Film Center. Colorado Office of Economic Development and International Trade Deputy Director Jeff Kraft told the EDC on Thursday. The new deal structure allows the entity that's going to issue the bond, CECFA, to also be the near-term owner of the project, he said. CECFA was always going to be the long-term owner once the bonds were paid off. This is a streamlining and simplification of the ownership structure. If the Colorado Educational and Cultural Facilities Authority's new plan comes to fruition, the state will own the Stanley upon repayment of the bonds, still expected to total more than $400 million, and revenues from the property will flow back into the coffers at CECFA, which, according to its website, is the official state issuer of tax-exempt bonds for capital projects, furthering the missions of educational and cultural organizations. Kraft said the CECFA is going to use the profits that the hotel generates from operations after the bonds are paid off for philanthropic purposes in Colorado. Whether CECFA will be the permanent owner of the Stanley remains to be seen. The amendment also allows the EDC to further modify and tweak the ownership structure as partnerships and events might unfold, Kraft said. Many details of the transaction, like the Stanley itself, remain mysterious. For example, state and hotel officials have not specified how much Grand Heritage stands to profit on the deal if the sale goes through. Economic Development Commissioners and OEDIT staffers spent about 30 minutes on Thursday in an executive session discussing what Kraft described as commercially sensitive information. It remains unclear why the previous iteration of the hotel acquisition plan, which had been reviewed by several state regulatory boards in late 2023 and early 2024, wasn't completed. Community Finance Corp did not respond to requests for comment on Thursday. With the EDC's approval, CECFA must now ask for permission from Colorado lawmakers, who will adjourn the 2024 legislative session next month, to expand its operational mandate to include certain new functions it would take on as the owner of the Stanley. State officials and Grand Heritage Hotel Group owner John Cullen, whose company is expected to continue operating the hotel upon the state's acquisition, have said repeatedly in recent months that a sale of the Stanley is necessary to fund important improvements such as the completion of the Stanley Film Center. Earth Week, Diary of a Changing World, week ending Friday, April 19th, 2024. Safe Passage. Bird experts are asking residents across the United States and Canada to help prevent the up to 30 bird deaths per second that can occur during the spring migration from February 15th to June 15th due to collisions with human-made objects. Up to a billion birds die each year in the United States when they crash into the windows and other structures made with reflective, transparent material, said Andrew Farnsworth at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He recommends homeowners turn off non-essential lighting from 11 p.m. to 6 a.m. or to draw curtains. He also suggests adding shields to external lighting to direct light downward instead of up into the sky. Earthquakes. 9 people were injured in a sharp quake that rocked a wide area of southern Japan. Earth movements also were felt in eastern Papua New Guinea, southeastern South Australia, Italy's Tuscany region, the desert resorts of Southern California, and West Texas. El Nino fades. Climate experts say that a switch in the coming months from a strong El Nino warming of the tropical Pacific to a possible La Nina cooling later this year will help them determine if the recent unprecedented high temperatures worldwide have been due to accelerated climate change or not. NOAA predicts there is an 85% chance the El Nino warmth will be gone sometime before June, while Australia's Bureau of Meteorology says the tropical Pacific sea surface already cooled substantially during mid-April. The absence of that heat will reduce the vertical wind shear that typically squashes hurricane and tropical storm development in the Atlantic Basin, possibly leading to a very active hurricane season. Dog sperm bank. Scientists in Africa are freezing sperm from genetically diverse male African wild dogs to be used in an artificial insemination program designed to help the endangered species survive. Only around 6,600 are believed to still exist in habitats that have become highly fragmented due to human encroachment. This is causing the canines to interbreed, reducing their genetic diversity. It is hoped that collecting sperm from many isolated communities and using it for breeding across Africa will also bring resistance to canine distemper and other illnesses that have decimated wild dog populations. Coral bleaching. Coral reefs across at least 54 countries and territories are suffering from a global bleaching phenomenon brought on by an unprecedented warming of the world's oceans for more than a year. Bleaching occurs when coral becomes stressed and turns white because the water it lives in is too hot, causing it to expel the symbiotic algae that normally cover it. The global bleaching started last year in the Florida Keys when water there became as warm as a hot tub. It then spread to the southern hemisphere and now affects more than half of the world's coral. Plastic seabeds. A new international study estimates that there are now vast amounts of plastic pollution blanketing the planet's seabeds. We discovered that the ocean floor has become a resting place or reservoir for most plastic pollution, with between 3 to 11 million tons of plastic estimated to be sinking to the ocean floor, said senior research scientist Dennis Hardesty of Australia's Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. It's believed the majority of the plastic is clustered around the continents and resides less than 660 feet beneath the surface. Eruption. A massive evacuation of thousands of people was launched after Indonesia's Mount Ruang stratovolcano in northern Sulawesi province spewed lava and other volcanic debris. The volcanic island of the same name was evacuated, and houses on a nearby island were riddled with holes from falling volcanic stones. will now be reading an editorial. No, undocumented immigrants aren't more crime-prone. They are less so. From Donald Trump's vitriolic description of Mexican immigrants during his 2015 presidential campaign announcement to Alabama Senator Katie Britt's speech last month using a young woman's tragic murder to excoriate the Biden administration's border policies, Republicans today have weaponized a toxic trope with disturbing precedents in the United States. Fact, immigrants to the U.S., including illegal immigrants, commit violent crime here at significantly lower, not higher rates than native-born Americans. That's not a justification for illegal immigration, but it should stand as an indictment of the truly ugly lie that Trump and his party are peddling right now in an effort to ride racial fear and xenophobia back into the White House. After framing his first campaign from the start as an attack on immigrants as inherently dangerous, Trump has twisted that foul lie like a knife. His most recent declaration that immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country was literally Hitlerian. The shock that even many Republican office holders initially expressed with Trump's ham-handed demagoguery regarding immigration, including legal immigration, which he effectively reduced by almost half as president, apparently has worn off. That was clear from Senator Britt's March 7th State of the Union response speech on behalf of the GOP. Most of the chatter regarding Britt's overwrought performance focused on her grossly misleading account of the human trafficking of a migrant, which it turns out didn't happen in the U.S., nor during President Joe Biden's tenure. But Britt's technically factual account of the murder of 22-year-old nursing student Lakin Riley in Georgia in February was also misleading in a more subtle and dangerous way. The murder allegedly by an undocumented Venezuelan migrant was as tragic as any other, but Britt's focus on the suspect as one of the millions of illegal border crossers President Biden chose to release into our homeland treats the incidental factor of his migrant status as if it's the whole point. And her seething exhortation that innocent Americans are dying was clearly meant to foster the impression that there is an epidemic of violent migrant crime afoot. That's the opposite of true. The fact that migrants who are in the U.S. illegally have lower violent crime rates than those born here is neither seriously disputed nor particularly surprising. It's not surprising because, by definition, foreign nationals living in America without legal immigrant status have every incentive to stay out of trouble and avoid attracting the attention of authorities. Illegal immigration is indeed a serious issue that must be addressed. The Biden administration tried to do that recently with bipartisan border reform legislation that gave immigration hardliners virtually everything they have sought on the issue lately. And House Republicans killed it at Trump's command because he knows the border crisis is more useful to him politically than a solution. That's politics, but what Trump and his GOP enablers are doing to foster panic over an immigrant crime wave that doesn't exist is worse than that. Virtually every surge of immigration in America's history has been met with some degree of fear, prejudice, and the false vilification of migrants as criminals. That is perhaps a sadly inherent element of human nature. But when a presidential candidate and his entire party build their electoral case around that putrid lie, it must be relentlessly called out. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch. NBA playoffs. Murray sends out warning to Lakers. We'll all shoot better next game, says Nuggets star guard, by Bennett Durando. If what Jamal Murray says is true, the Lakers have already missed their window to make this playoff rematch a compelling series. Murray believes the Nuggets were too amped on adrenaline early in Game 1 before they ran away with a 114-103 victory that extended their head-to-head win streak to 9 games. He believes the excitement affected the Nuggets' shot-making, including his own, on open looks. They needed to settle down, and eventually they did. It reminded him of their playoff opener in 2023. I think it's just a greater energy at the beginning, you know what I'm saying? You put a little bit more on your jump shots. I did for sure, Murray said. I remember last year, Game 1 against Minnesota, it was the same kind of thing. You're just anticipating so much energy, so much adrenaline running through your body. Sometimes you've just got to relax and just take a shot like it's practice. I wasn't shooting like it was practice in the first half. Back in Los Angeles, there's an ominous subtext to that observation. The Nuggets shot 6 for 23, 26% from a three-point range in the first half Saturday, primarily on quality looks created by double teams on Nikola Jokic, and only trailed 60 to 57. The Lakers needed flawless game planning and execution in the first quarter. They ended the frame with a 137.5 offensive rating and a bunch of baffling misses from Denver just to come up for air with one possession lead at intermission. Then the Nuggets made five of their first 8 3-pointers after halftime, and game one was over. If what Murray says is true, if that first half won't be replicated because it was merely an annual case of game one jitters, then the Lakers might need a miracle to pull off this upset. For what it's worth, in game one against the Timberwolves, Murray shot 3 for 10 from the floor in the first half. The rest of the series, he was 48.9% from the field and 43.6% from three-point range. Denver advanced in 5 games. Murray was 3 for 11 in the first game of this first half of this game one. What exactly constitutes shooting like it's practice, by the way? It's your whole mood and spirit, Murray explained. You can rush your shot, you can not have your feet set, you can obviously still hit it. But I felt like I was rushing my shot early on. Just so excited to see it go in, I think. I just remember last year it was the same thing against Minnesota. It took me until the second half to kind of make a couple. So, not just me, I think we'll all shoot better next game. Speaking of mirror images with last year, if what Lakers coach Darvin Ham says is true, this could be spiraling down towards another 4-game sweep. Ham told reporters the Lakers still have a few more defensive adjustments to deploy against Jokic, who amassed 32 points on 65% shooting without a turnover in game one. Rui Hachimura guarded him for the majority of the series opener, often fronting him to attempt to deny post catches. In the first half, sending a second defender to the ball worked against Jokic because his teammates were missing those open threes. Not so much later. The two-time MVP also saw a bit of LeBron James and Anthony Davis. After the loss, Ham said the Lakers didn't want to use all of their adjustments in Game 1. Rewind the tape to Game 1 of the 2023 Western Conference Finals. In the fourth quarter, Hachimura took over as the primary matchup on Jokic, while Davis roamed over with a weak side help. It achieved brief success. We didn't want to go too deep into the in-game adjustments, Ham said after the game. It's still that ultimate chess game, so we were comfortable with the results. It gave us a chance to get back into the game, and it's one of the things that we know if we need to go back to it, it's there. But along with several other things we didn't unveil tonight, that little tease sparked an entire news cycle of speculation and debate between games. Turns out the secrets he didn't unveil that night were 3 more losses. It's 9 in a row now for the Lakers, and yet Ham's comments indicate an eerily similar approach to this rematch, as if they haven't fully learned their lesson. While they're ignoring the past, Murray is drawing from his. It's why he didn't even consider panicking when the Nuggets fell behind by 12 at home. On one possession early in the third quarter, he even gestured for his teammates to settle down before he initiated a play. Denver was in the heart of a 17-point swing over 10 minutes. Aurora. Prosthetics orders canceled improperly by Sam Tabachnik. The head of the prosthetics department at Aurora's Rocky Mountain Regional VA Medical Center improperly canceled 1,000 orders without contacting veterans who sought artificial limbs, hearing aids, and other devices to help them live more functional lives, a regional veteran affairs leader acknowledged. Sunandina Kumar Geibel, director of the VA Rocky Mountain Network, which includes the Aurora Hospital, confirmed the Denver Post reporting from November that first uncovered the prosthetics order deletion scheme that left vets without necessary equipment. The consults were closed outside of the guidelines, she said Friday in the VA's first interview on the topic. Leadership, after being made aware of the deleted orders, instructed outside VA staff to call every patient on the list to ensure that they received what they needed, Kumar Geibel said. Multiple whistleblowers told the Post in November that the prosthetics chief, Norma Mestes, instructed lower-level staff to delete these orders as if they had never come in, to help alleviate a substantial backlog. She also deleted orders personally, employees said. Kumar Geibel said the VA brought in outside staff to ease the logjam. There are now 0 delayed prosthetic orders, she said, and none have been in the system for more than 3 days. Mestes is now working at the Grand Junction VA in an administrative role pending the conclusion of a federal investigation, the regional director said. She did not respond to calls from the Post seeking comment. The revelations come as the Aurora VA has been mired in turmoil for the past 6 months. In October, leadership removed the Eastern Colorado Systems Director, Michael Kilmer, and his chief of staff, Shilpa Rungta, while citing vague operational oversight and culture concerns. The following month, the Post revealed the prosthetic scandal, as well as numerous reports from staff, spelling out an environment of fear and retaliation that spanned multiple departments. The removal and subsequent reporting by the Post prompted congressional oversight from the U.S. Representative Jason Crow, an Aurora Democrat and former Army Ranger, who demanded a thorough accounting of the prosthetics deletions. Leadership in December also reassigned the nationally renowned director of the Aurora VA Suicide Prevention Center after union officials detailed to the Post emotional, mental, and psychological abuse toward its staff. That director, Lisa Brenner, remains in a temporary position outside the center as the VA's internal investigation wraps up, leadership said. VA brass in Friday's interview also offered additional details concerning the October removal of the Aurora Hospital's leadership. Dr. Sharif Elnahal, the VA's undersecretary for health, said repeated reports concluded staff at the Aurora VA did not feel comfortable raising concerns about patient care and other work-related issues. Staff also outlined retaliation concerns that dissuaded them from giving feedback. It was made clear that the sentiment around the employees at the Denver VA was overwhelmingly one where psychological safety and comfort in raising concerns to leadership was compromised, Elnahal said. Additional red flags came when a number of people in executive leadership departed in rapid succession. That's a very big concern, Elnahal said. You need to have stable leadership. In the Aurora Hospital's intensive care unit, leadership initiated a fact-finding mission in the wake of the Post reporting last month that detailed allegations from staff of unsafe practices, including nurses taking on more patients than is generally deemed acceptable. Whistleblowers also said leadership in one case instructed providers to give a patient an unknown tincture provided by a family member. VA leaders on Friday did not acknowledge there were unsafe protocols in the Aurora ICU, but Kumar Geibel said the unit strives to include more transparent communication of decision-making between leaders and staff. We'll now be reading articles from the Longmont Times Call. TC's Tip. Dear TC, I read your article last week about the bans on polystyrene and single-use plastic bags, and I'm happy to hear about this new law and its positive environmental impacts. I want to spread the word so people are on board like me. You talked about enforcement, but can you provide details as to why this bill was passed? Thanks, Sophia. Dear Sophia, I'm so glad you asked. In case others missed it, under the new Plastic Pollution Reduction Act, PPRA, Colorado retail food establishments are prohibited from distributing polystyrene foam containers, commonly referred to as styrofoam, due to their detrimental environmental and health impacts. According to the Children's Environmental Health Network, more than 50 chemical byproducts are released during the manufacturing of polystyrene foam, and some are known carcinogens that can easily leach into whatever the container is holding, like, say, hot food or beverages. Want some hot soup in a foam container? Personally, it's a hard pass. This material is not recyclable. It's the most common plastic found as litter, and it breaks down into microplastics that can kill wildlife if ingested. There are plenty of safer and more sustainable alternatives to foam-to-go containers and cups. So to protect human health and the environment, the state has prohibited the use of polystyrene foam for these purposes. Additionally, under the PPRA, large retailers are now restricted from distributing single-use plastic checkout bags, and a fee of 10 cents is imposed on single-use paper bags. Plastic bags are predominantly made from natural gases, a finite natural resource with an extraction process that has significant climate impacts, while paper bags are often made from old-growth trees. The sheer volume of disposable bags creates an enormous yet preventable environmental impact. According to the Colorado Public Interest Research Group, COPIRG, an estimated 4.6 million single-use plastic bags are used daily in Colorado. Phasing out single-use plastic checkout bags and placing a small fee on paper checkout bags is a policy solution that has proven to reduce plastic pollution. You're not alone in your excitement about this bill. According to a recent Oceana poll, 84% of American voters support increasing the use of reusable packaging and food serviceware. 80% support requiring companies to reduce their single-use plastic packaging and food serviceware, and 81% support shifting the cost of cleaning up plastic pollution from taxpayers to the business that make it. This bill is expected to help businesses save money by reducing needless single-use materials. According to a recent report by Upstream under the PPRA, a small business is expected to save $3,000 to $22,000 in materials costs, eliminate 1,300 to 2,200 pounds of waste, and reduce 110,000 to 225,000 packaging items annually. Now go spread the word about this win for Coloradans everywhere. It's a great way to celebrate Earth Day. TC. Got zero waste questions? We have answers. Email ecocycle at ecocycle.org, Rosie at ecocycle.org. Call 303-444-6634. Check the Ecocycle A to Z Recycling app or visit ecocycle.org. Johnny St. Vrain, the Orange Kangaroo and Automatic Tire Chains. Hello, Johnny. Recently, I was stopped behind a St. Vrain school bus while at a red light. There was a sticker on the back of the bus saying Orange Kangaroo. I had not heard of this in relation to the schools. Do you know what it references? I was also intrigued by the automatic tire chains. I would appreciate a brief explanation if possible and if you have time. Thank you, an inquiring mind. Hello, inquiring mind. Imagine yourself to be a 6 or 7 year old child just learning how to navigate the school district's transportation system, knowing when to catch the bus, knowing where to catch the bus, and very importantly, catching the right bus. At the end of a long, hard day, learning, reading, writing, arithmetic, and how to manage a glue stick, it might be difficult to remember that your bus is number 189. However, if your bus is the Orange Kangaroo, well, that might not be so hard to remember at all, and it would engage your imagination. I mean, if you were a kid, it sure would. The Orange Kangaroo sticker you noticed on the back of the bus is part of our Department of Transportation Services color and animal identification system designed to help our younger riders easily recognize their assigned buses. Lance Yokesmer, Executive Director of Transportation for St. Vrain Valley Schools, said in an email reply when I forwarded your query to the district. Traditionally, bus identification relied on numbers displayed on the buses, Yokesmer said. Over 5 years ago, St. Vrain Valley Schools introduced a color and animal identification system as an additional safety measure to help the district's youngest riders locate their buses more easily. Each bus has a unique combination of a color and an animal. Each student who rides the bus is assigned an animal and a color displayed as a magnet on their bus, and they also receive a matching sticker on their bus pass. This system assists students in identifying their assigned bus and serves as an added safety measure for bus drivers who verify that the student's bus pass matches the color and the animal of the bus they are boarding. Inquiring mind, in addition to that magnetic decal you see on the back of the bus, there's a matching decal next to the door. The district uses 24 animals in its system: bumblebee, butterfly, cheetah, crocodile, dinosaur, dolphin, duck, elk, fish, flamingo, frog, giraffe, hamster, iguana, kangaroo, ladybug, lobster, manta ray, octopus, panda, peacock, penguin, spider, and zebra. There are 5 colors per animal: red, orange, yellow, green, and blue. This system is more than enough to individually label the 98 buses currently in operation in the St. Vrain Valley School District. Now about those automatic tire chains. I also have been curious about them. Your question prompted me to learn more. Having put chains on tires before, I had pondered such a process could be automated. It's not. These automatic chains don't wrap around the tires. Each rotates on a different axis under the tire. Here's my simple explanation of the system. Tucked under the bus, just inside each interior rear tire, is an arm on which there's a wheel. Attached around the perimeter of each wheel, there are segments of chain. When the driver flips the switch, the arms lower until the edge of each wheel comes into contact with the interior of each tire's sidewall. This causes the wheel to begin spinning in sync with the tire as the chain segments, due to centrifugal force, extend from the wheel. Each segment of the chain swings toward the contact point between the tire and the pavement. The tire rolls over the chain segment, then that segment whips back around until it engages with the road and tire again. Inquiring mind, if that wasn't clear, watch this video on YouTube, www.youtube.com/watch?V=A(EM17D70/TS. Thanks for the interesting question. Send your questions to Johnny@timescall.com. Israel. More strikes in Gaza killed 22, including 18 children, by Mohammed Jajou and Sammy Magdi, the Associated Press. Rafah, Gaza Strip. Israeli strikes on the southern Gaza city of Rafah overnight killed 22 people, including 18 children, health officials said Sunday, as the United States was on track to approve billions of dollars of additional military aid to Israel, its close ally. Israel has carried out nearly deadly raids on Rafah, where more than half of Gaza's population of 2.3 million has sought refuge from fighting elsewhere. It has also vowed to expand its ground offensive against Hamas to the city on the border with Egypt, despite calls for restraint, including from the U.S. In the coming days, we will increase the political and military pressure on Hamas because this is the only way to bring back our hostages and achieve victory. We will land more and more painful blows on Hamas soon, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said in a statement. He didn't give details. The first Israeli strike in Rafah killed a man, his wife, and their three-year-old child, according to the nearby Kuwaiti hospital, which received the bodies. The woman was pregnant and the doctor saved the baby, the hospital said. The second strike killed 17 children and two women from an extended family. These children were sleeping. What did they do? What was their fault? Asked one relative, Karim Mohammed Al-Berry, said that Mohammed Al-Berry said that his daughter Rasha and her six children, the youngest 18 months old, were among those killed. A woman and three children were still under the rubble. The Israeli-Hamas war has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians, according to local health officials, at least two-thirds of them children and women. It has devastated Gaza's two largest cities and left a swath of destruction. Around 80% of the territory's population have fled to other parts of the besieged coastal enclave. The $26 billion aid package approved by the U.S. House of Representatives on Saturday includes around $9 billion for humanitarian assistance for Gaza, which experts say is on the brink of famine. The U.S. Senate could pass the package as soon as Tuesday, and President Joe Biden has promised to sign it immediately. The conflict, now in its seventh month, has sparked regional unrest, pitting Israel and the U.S. against Iran and allied militant groups across the Middle East. Israel and Iran traded fire directly this month, raising fears of an all-out war. Tensions have also spiked in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Israeli troops killed two Palestinians who the military says attacked a checkpoint with a knife and a gun near the southern western bank town of Hebron early Sunday. The Palestinian Health Ministry said that the two killed were 18 and 19 from the same family. No Israeli forces were wounded, the army said. Later, the military said its forces shot dead a 43-year-old Palestinian woman after she tried to stab a soldier in the northern West Bank near Bekaa settlement. The Palestinian Red Crescent Rescue Service said that it had recovered 14 bodies from an Israeli raid in the Nur Shams urban refugee camp in the West Bank that began late Thursday. Those killed included three militants from the Islamic Jihad group and a 15-year-old boy. The military said it killed 14 militants and arrested eight suspects. 10 Israeli soldiers and one border police officer were wounded. In a separate incident in the West Bank, an Israeli man was wounded in an explosion on Sunday, the Magen David Adam Rescue Service said. A video circulating online shows a man approaching a Palestinian flag planted in a field. When he kicks it, it appears to trigger an explosive device. At least 469 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers in the West Bank since the start of the Israeli-Hamas war, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Most have been killed during Israeli military raids or in violent protests. The war was sparked by an unprecedented October 7th raid into southern Israel, in which Hamas and other militants killed around 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and abducted around 250 hostages. Israel says militants are still holding around 100 hostages and the remains of more than 30 others. Hamas has been designated as a terrorist organization by the United States, Canada, and the European Union. Thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets to call for a new election to replace Netanyahu and a deal with Hamas to release the hostages. Netanyahu has vowed to continue the war until Hamas is destroyed and all hostages are returned. The war has killed at least 34,097 Palestinians and wounded another 76,980, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The ministry doesn't differentiate between combatants and civilians in its count. Leaders criticize expected U.S. sanctions against military unit by Joseph Fetterman, the Associated Press, Jerusalem. Israeli leaders on Sunday harshly criticized an expected decision by the U.S. to impose sanctions on a unit of ultra-Orthodox soldiers in the Israeli military. The decision, expected as soon as Monday, would mark the first time the U.S. has imposed sanctions on a unit inside the Israeli military and would further strain relations between the two allies, which have grown increasingly tense during Israel's war in Gaza. While U.S. officials declined to identify the unit expected to be sanctioned, Israeli leaders and local media identified it as Netzah Yehuda, an infantry battalion founded roughly a quarter century ago to incorporate ultra-Orthodox men into the military. Many religious men receive exemptions from what is supposed to be compulsory service. Israeli leaders condemned the anticipated decision as unfair, especially at a time when Israel is at war, and vowed to oppose it. If anyone thinks they can impose sanctions on a unit in the IDF, I will fight it with all my might, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said. Netzah Yehuda, or Judea Forever, has historically been based in the occupied West Bank, and some of its members have been linked to abuses against Palestinians. It makes up just a small part of Israel's military presence in the territory. The unit came under a heavy American criticism in 2022 after an older Palestinian-American man was found dead shortly after he was detained at a West Bank checkpoint. A Palestinian autopsy said Omar Assad, 78, had underlying health conditions but suffered a heart attack caused by external violence. It said doctors found bruises on his head, redness on his wrist from being bound, and bleeding in his eyelids from being tightly blindfolded. A military investigation said that Israeli soldiers assumed that Assad was asleep when they cut off the cables binding his hands. They didn't offer medical help when they saw that he was unresponsive and left the scene without checking to see if he was alive. Assad had lived in the U.S. for 4 decades. After an outcry from the U.S. government, the Israeli ministry said the incident was a grave and unfortunate event resulting from moral failure and poor decision-making on the part of the soldiers. It said one officer was being reprimanded and 2 other officers reassigned to non-commanding roles over the incident. But the army decided against criminal prosecution, saying military investigators could not directly link their actions to the death of the U.S. citizen. Human rights groups long have argued that Israel rarely holds soldiers accountable for the deaths of Palestinians. Investigators said soldiers were forced to restrain Assad because of his aggressive resistance. Assad's family has expressed skepticism that the behavior of an ailing 78-year-old could justify such harsh treatment. Amid the uproar with the U.S., Israel moved Netzah Yehuda out of the West Bank in late 2022 and reassigned it to northern Israel. The battalion was moved to the southern border with Gaza after Hamas's October 7th attack triggered the ongoing war. In a statement Sunday, the army said Netzah Yehuda soldiers are currently participating in the war effort in the Gaza Strip. The battalion is professionally and bravely conducting operations in accordance with the IDF Code of Ethics and with full commitment to international law, it said. It said that if the unit is sanctioned, its consequences will be reviewed. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Friday that he had made a decision on reviews of allegations that several Israeli military units had violated conditions for receiving U.S. assistance outlined in the so-called Leahy Law, and that they would soon be made public. The White House declined to comment and referred to Blinken's comments from Friday. Benny Gantz, a former military defense minister and current member of Israel's war cabinet, sent in a statement that he spoke Sunday evening with Blinken and told him that the expected decision is a mistake because it would harm Israel's international legitimacy during wartime and because Israel's judicial system is strong and independent. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, another member of the war cabinet, said he delivered a similar message to U.S. Ambassador to Israel Jack Lew and planned on talking to Blinken with hopes of blocking the expected decision. Today, Job Seekers Club, 9:30 a.m. Monday, Carbon Valley Regional Library, 7 Park Avenue, Firestone. A Job Seekers Club is an informal networking group of people who are engaged in the process of job searching and people who are interested in discussing the current workforce landscape and other employment-related topics. Free, 888-861-7323, highplains.libcal.com. Open mic at Bootstrap Brewing, 6 p.m. Monday. Bootstrap Brewing Company, 142 Pratt Street, Longmont. Play a tune on stage and nab a free beer. Performers can sign up to play starting at 5:30 p.m. Holler at dennis.m.driscoll@comcast.net for questions, 303-652-4186, bootstrapbrewing.com. Teen Finer Arts Club, 4 p.m. Tuesday, Library, 409 4th Avenue, Longmont. 6th to 12th graders can join for a monthly Finer Arts Club where they'll explore different art forms and projects. Supplies and instructions will be provided for each project. This month, participants will make resin gummy bears and initial keychains. LongmontColorado.gov. Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Daily Camera and Longmont Times Call, read by Anita Head.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.